Lee Taylor is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where final preparations are underway to execute Taylor by injecting him with massive doses of drugs usually used to save lives. Over the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will provide live coverage and commentary on the state killing. Taylor says his execution would not be taking place if prosecutors hadn't played foul by giving the jury evidence about a murder committed while he was a juvenile. Execution Watch host Otis McClay, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Dr. Dennis Longmire, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special interview guest Elizabeth Calvin, senior advocate, Children's Rights Division, Human Rights Watch. The Execution Watch begins.
Hey, yes, this is Execution Watch. If you tuned in for alternative radio, it is not going to be heard today because every time there's an execution in the state of Texas so far, we, at 6 p.m., we go on the air with the story about the person that we're killing in the name of all of us and the background for that. So this is Execution Watch. I am not Ray Hill. I'm Otis McClay. Ray is giving a speech today, so he's not here. And I'm here in the studio with a number of important people. Jim Skelton is here. Jim Skelton is normally on the show. Susan Ashley is here. And I think you've been coming on the show regularly.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Larry Douglas is here, which was the mellifluous and elegant voice that you heard
the
at
what?
The beginning. And also with us is Robert Mudd, who has done a considerable amount of time and probably has some things to say about this particular execution. But before we do anything, let's go to Huntsville. And with us in Huntsville is Professor Dennis Longmire, who is at Sam Houston College there. Hi, Dennis.
Hello. I'm sorry I couldn't hear the full lead-in, so I can't remember your name, but you're Ray's stand-in. Hello.
I'm Ray's stand-in. This is Ray's stand-in. So tell me what's going on there at Ground Zero.
Right now, both waves of the witnesses have just entered. The witnesses, okay, for Tiny are just walking in right now. About 2 or 3 seconds before that, the witnesses for the media went in, which, of course, is the sign for us here on the corner that unfortunately, the execution is going forward. There are about 14 of us, a group of people from the Dallas area and a group of people from Houston are up here. And so it's a fairly large crowd, larger than normal. Normally, there are about 7. And I think that now there are 13 or 14 of us. I don't do math well, so.
So are there pro-execution people there as well?
No, the only pro-execution people... The only pro-execution people would be the correctional officers who are guarding the yellow line, and I only suspect that they're pro-execution. But it's very rare that people are out here in support of the executions.
So we've got about 13 people. Why do you think there are more than usual?
Well, from what I can gather, Tiny has a lot of people who really supported him, a lot of people who have come to know him through other guys that they're visiting. A number of the people who are here, and as a matter of fact, of the 13, 4 of us are men. All of the others are women. And people who have been visiting guys on the row and giving love and support for the guys on the row, which helped the guys on the row live. I genuinely believe that the support that the guys on the row get from the free worlders keeps them alive.
Okay. Well, I guess, you know, you will call Elizabeth at the moment when they come out, which is when we know it took place.
I will do that.
All right. Professor Dennis Longmire on Ground Zero at the walls in Huntsville. We'll be back with you. Well, you know, we can always hope that we won't hear from you again, but it looks pretty bad. So this is Execution Watch. I'm in the studio with Jim Skelton, Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, and Robert Mudd. Jim, we haven't even said the name of Lee Taylor yet, the person that we're executing. So why don't we go down the list of what's going on.
Well, what's happening, the history of this case. It's not what you call a typical death penalty case. And frankly, as I was talking to everybody here before we got on the air, I don't think this ever deserved the death penalty. What happened? This was a kid from Galveston, Texas. When he was 16 years old, he got involved in a robbery. He went over to Channel View with, I think, a girl was with him, and they robbed an elderly couple, and he beat up the elderly man. The elderly man later died. And he was 16 at the time, and he was certified over as adult, and the jury gave him a life sentence. So he ended up in prison serving a life sentence at the age of 16. And we keep forgetting that, you know, it's the mentality of a 16-year-old kid. But when you get thrown in a situation like that, you've got to have some sort of protection. So he did what a lot of people do in prison, especially those who are very young. He got involved in one of the gangs. He became a member of the Aryan Brotherhood. And then what happened...
Now, of course, he maintains later, and I think other people corroborated, he did this out of self-defense. In other words, to protect himself from...
He never said it. Self-defense was never an issue at trial.
Okay, I saw that in it.
He never did. What happened in this case, and you've got to understand, Larry Douglas had mentioned this earlier. In fact, Mr. Mudd had mentioned this earlier, that we put him in a culture that we almost, in a sense, required him to join a gang. And you also put him in a culture where the rules of prison are entirely different than the rules of people walking on the street. And what happened, there was a African-American inmate by the name of Donta Green that went into another white man's cell and supposedly stole some things out of his cell. Well, when you're in that prison culture, that cannot go unpunished. I mean, that's part of the culture that we created by making prisons, and that's part of the culture we put this kid in. And so what happened, but of course by that time he had aged up until about 20 years old, so he went from 16 to 20, when he spent 4 years in prison being a member of a prison gang. So as a part of the prison code, what happened, he and another inmate that the property was stolen from decided to kill Green. So what happened the next morning when the cell doors were open, Taylor walked past Green, hit him in the face, and grabbed him around the neck and began to stab him with the shank and killed him. He ended up stabbing him something like 13 times, and most of them were fatal blows, and he ended up killing him. And like I say, that was in retaliation. In fact, he said when he was stabbing, "You've been stealing. You shouldn't be stealing." You know, that was a part of that prison code. You can't let that go unpunished. And so after the killing, what really hurt him in front of the jury, there never was a self-defense claim because he grabbed around a...
No, I meant defense from other gangs. I didn't mean defense legally.
It was part of the prison code. I don't think had a damn thing to do with prison gangs. That's part of the code you live by, I think. At this point, I'd like for... Roger, Mr. Mudd, would you step in and talk about what I mentioned about
the prison code? I think what Otis is talking about, he joined the gangs as
for protection,
a form of self-defense.
Right. That's what I said.
Yeah.
I used the wrong word.
Yeah, okay, yeah, right. And that's absolutely right. I mean, that's the culture of prison, especially, like you say, for a young person. When you go into a prison and you're immediately confronted and pressured and, you know, and a lot of times you have no other options but to become a gang member.
Because really what we did, in a sense, is put him in a culture and he acted according to that culture, and now we're going to kill him because he acted in accordance with the culture that we put him in. Basically, is it. Isn't that true?
Yeah, that's correct.
But let's talk about the flip side of this. And I've asked Susan Ashley to kind of go in some of the prior criminal history, and part of the reason is why perhaps the jury was outraged enough and given the death sentence. I'd like for Susan to talk about the robbery
case. Before we go on, Dave Longmire, Professor Dave Longmire, no? I'm not sure. You need to push the button and tell me what you mean. Oh, Dave Atwood. Oh, okay. All right, Dave, so you're at a vigil?
Yeah, this is Dave.
Right, I'm sorry. Pick the wrong guy. So where are you guys? Are you guys... You're here in Houston, vigilante.
Yeah, we're
Houston.
In Houston. We're at the corner of Westheimer and Shepherd by St. Anne's Church. We're out on the curb.
How many?
We've only got about four here tonight.
Anybody honking?
Oh, yeah. We get lots of honks. I mean, this is a pretty good corner. Hundreds of cars go by, so the visibility is really great. And we were here last night, too, but, of course, it was called off.
All right. Well, it looks like this one's going to go through. Yeah.
Is this going to go through?
Yeah.
Have you heard? Like.
Well, they're in there.
They're in
Everybody's
there now,
in.
Huh?
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
All right. Let's catch you later.
Okay. This will be number 230 for Rick Perry.
Oh, yeah. Well, that'll that'll be good for getting him as president.
Yeah, well, you know, he says he's pro-life.
Right, whatever that means. All right, thanks, okay. Dave Atwood. Standing on the corner of Shepherd and...
Westheimer.
Yeah, Westheimer, right at St. Anne's Church. That's where they normally are. And what they do is they hold up signs so that if you propose the death penalty, honk, and a lot of people honk. Okay, I'm sorry, I interrupted you and Robert.
Well, I was going to ask Susan, because you got to go to the flip side of this. We talked about putting him in the culture, but as Susan pointed out, he did some things to get himself put in that culture. I wanted Susan to discuss some of the priors. I wanted to come back, if I could, to Robert and talk some more about the prison culture we've talked about earlier. Go ahead, Susan.
Taylor, in 1995, must have been, I assume it was a home invasion. He entered the home of an elderly couple, an old man and woman, and
That was in Channelview, wasn't it, Susan?
Yes, okay. It was in Channelview. He beat them. Obviously, he beat the man bad enough that the man died from the beating.
Was it later or that night? It was later, wasn't it?
What I saw was that it was at the hospital later that the guy died. It was actually a couple days later.
Yeah. I don't really think it would really make any difference to anyone. Anyway, so he got a life sentence on that. He was 16. It was 1995. After he got a life sentence, this case happens in 1999. He's 20 years old in 1999. So I assume that when the jury heard this case, they heard about his past, his prior, and I think that the violent nature of the assault on the elderly couple probably was instrumental in them giving him the death penalty.
As opposed to the violent nature of the assault in prison?
Not opposed.
No, but I'm saying that first of all, another thing that's interesting about this case, this is the second execution in Texas history, I believe, for killing a white person killing a black man. This is the second one
mm-hmm.
of Texas all history. Of them. In all of our executions, that's two. It's kind of a statement about Texas, and I wonder, which suggests that they wouldn't have given him the death penalty for the crime in prison, but they were going back to the original one.
Well, I think the previous offense, I think, would have an effect on a jury assessing punishment. I mean, because the first killing was must have been a home invasion. He beat this couple so badly that, and this was an elderly couple, and the man died. So they were home minding their own business, and I think that probably did have a lot of effect on the jury.
So what you're saying,
at the same time, he did it when he was 16 years old, and we all know that the behavior of 16 year olds is a lot different from people who are 40.
Yes.
Well, sometimes.
Yes. I mean, that's fair to say.
We know that as people get older, they tend to get less violent.
Have you become more mellow with age, Otis?
No, actually, it's quite the opposite. As I look around me and see all the way these politicians are behaving. But I mean, no, statistically, we know that when somebody's been in prison for 30 years, they're different when they get out than they were when they went in.
If you haven't been in, you're going to be different 30 years later, hopefully.
Well, I'm saying your glandular secretions have kind of lessened a little bit.
But if what you're basically saying, you probably got the death penalty for the beating rather than killing the inmates, what you're saying.
Yeah, which means that somehow the case wasn't focused on the case. Susan, did you have more you wanted to say?
Well,
because I didn't.
I would put it this way. I think I'm just going to kind of say this. I think people are, shall we say, more outraged because it's a threat to them. They're in a home. They certainly don't want someone coming in, beating them, and killing them. So that's perceived as much more threatening to them. One prisoner killing another prisoner, I don't think it doesn't strike people as quite as heinous or as threatening. And I'm not to diminish the prisoner who died's life in any way.
But I'm just saying
an example is if you have a fight where, as they say, one ex-con killed another ex-con, your results, your jury results, juries aren't outraged.
Bobby, anything to say about that, Bobby Mudd?
Yeah, well, I agree. I think she's right.
But get that mic.
Yeah.
You can have it all, okay. And then we can give it to
I agree with what she's saying. I mean, I believe absolutely the initial crime that he committed probably was the contributing factor and them finding, you know.
What's interesting, Robert, that's exactly what they argued in the Fifth Circuit. Because one of the issues in the Fifth Circuit, they basically, what you guys were talking about, he said that really I'm being punished for a crime I committed when I was 16.
Right.
And since they've ruled that you can't execute somebody under a juvenile,
right,
then I shouldn't be given the death sentence.
Yeah.
And the truth of the matter is, and this is where our courts sometimes play fiction, that is the truth. What Otis has said is true and what Susan said is true. He probably got the death penalty for the beating that occurred when he was 16 in reality.
Mm-hmm.
But the Fifth Circuit overlooked that. And what they you want to...
Well, I was just going to say, out of curiosity, because this has to do with the way the trial was conducted, theoretically, that prior record couldn't be introduced unless Lee Taylor himself testified.
That's not true.
That's not true.
No.
Okay.
The way it works in a death penalty case, and here's what makes some kind of sorry for death, it wouldn't be admitted as a general rule during... There's two phases to a criminal trial, guilt, innocence, and punishment. It would not be admitted as a general rule at the guilt-innocence phase unless something very unusual came up. But at punishment, our Code of Criminal Procedure says that virtually anything the judge deems relevant to the question of future dangerousness is going to come in. And they've let in, for example, at punishment hearings, they've let in cases where people have been acquitted on crimes, and they've admitted that. One of the more outrageous cases, a guy had been no-billed on a murder case in Dallas. And the grand jury said there wasn't enough evidence to go forward, yet when he later on was tried and was convicted at the punishment hearing, they introduced not only the fact that he was accused of the murder, they introduced the photographs of the murder.
Of a previous murder that he was no-billed on.
That's right. And so at the punishment hearing, virtually everything but the kitchen sink comes in. So what happened at punishment, when they had the punishment hearing, all the evidence involving the murder of the elderly couple came in. And that was his very argument in front of the Fifth Circuit, that I'm being punished for conduct I committed when I was 16. That's why the jury killed me. Just like you pointed out earlier. He got the death penalty for an act he did when he was 16. So if you're going to do that, then I should come under the purview of that Supreme Court case, and I shouldn't be given the death penalty because I was 16 when I did it. And they said, no, you killed an inmate when you were 20. Tough luck. And they affirmed the case.
Because that's what he was actually convicted for.
That's what he was tried and convicted for on capital murder.
And so this said, you know, that it, and what Susan, what you were saying about, you know, this is a home break-in, big emotional element.
Oh,
this is, and of course,
doubt.
The jury is charged to determine the facts, right? That's
without
their basic charge.
Without
determine
it.
The facts. And I think we could infer from this that there might be some emotional element.
Oh, clearly,
to this.
I mean, obviously, people might have been, shall we say, horrified by the first crime because it is a home invasion, elderly couple.
Yeah.
It was a brutal crime. And they might have thought, well, if you don't get the death penalty for the first murder, try not to commit a second one.
Yeah, and of course, the questions that the actual punishment phase has to do with the three questions, right?
Well, there's
ongoing.
It was an intentional deliberate act, which is pretty well.
Yeah. Well, they don't actually say this is the death penalty. They just have three questions to answer. Is he an ongoing menace to society?
That's not exactly what they do.
Is that true?
They ask three questions. The first question was an intentional deliberate act. Well, if you're found guilty, that answers yes on
okay.
that. Second question, is there a reasonable probability you'll commit criminal acts of violence in the future?
And he's in prison.
Well, he's killed, and then that's when they introduce evidence about the prior killing, and he put another killing. And then the next one, if they have evidence of some sort of mitigation where he's been mistreated as a child, they can give what they call a mitigation issue, but that apparently was not given in this case. And I think they want us to talk about Robert to talk about the...
The other kind of question, and this is the producer's pounding me, and that's her job. Has to do with the conditions inside prison and the, you know, violence, prisoner-on-prisoner violence.
Yeah, I mean, prison is a violent, you know, environment. I mean, as we were speaking out in the lobby, that the prison guards and prison administration, they encourage it. You know, you're not going to ever have one admit to that, but they encourage the violence because, as I was saying, that as long as they can keep the inmates at each other's throats, then they're not having to worry about them being on them.
Because the guards are in a minority.
Right,
basically,
right.
Basically.
Absolutely.
Inside.
And we have to understand there's people in prison right now that are there for murder and have committed murder while in prison. I know several people, and they're not on death row.
Now, this particular prison, which one was it?
Bedford Unit.
And is that a violent unit?
A Telford unit, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Telford is known as a violent unit. Most of the units are that way. I mean, there are a few exceptions to that rule, but as a general rule, just the prison environment itself is violent. And as we were saying, this guy went in, as he was a young kid, you know, and really it was, like you say, it was a form of self-defense, a protection. He joined the gang as you know, a form of protection. And unfortunately, it led to this murder. And
how common is this kind of a situation where somebody's getting murdered?
It's pretty common. It may not be as in the 1980s, Texas was considered the bloodiest prison system in the country. And at that point, they shut the units. They locked the system down in 1986, and that's when they began to supposedly segregate the gang members. And then at that point, I think they went to like 5,000 people that they placed in segregation. Oh, man.
That's expensive.
Yes.
The gangs are pretty much drawn across racial lines?
Absolutely, yeah.
So, who's not a member? I mean, are there any white guys in the prison who are not members of the Brotherhood?
I wasn't, but you know, I probably was an exception to the rule. As I was telling Jim,
you're a very diplomatic guy.
I became a writ writer.
Oh, okay.
And for that reason, the gangs respect someone that is trying to do something that is going to better the conditions for everyone.
Okay, for anyone who doesn't know, a writ writer is somebody who's writing appeals,
right,
and submitting them. And you know, you have access to the library.
Well, you know, as we were talking earlier, and again, this is not a fashionable thing to say, but there is a lot of racial tension in prison. And I agree with Jim. I think that if they were to begin to segregate the prison system more, it would reduce the
violence.
You mean
segregate across racial lines?
Right.
Let me explain
which
why.
Which we are not.
Yeah.
We can't.
Let me tell you why I said
now,
that,
right.
Otis, because truthfully, when you go back to the genesis of gangs, it started in 1950, and really it started out with a group of ex-motorcycle people that called themselves, I think, Diamond something gangs.
The Diamond Tooth Gang.
Yeah, because they put glass in their teeth.
Right.
And what they did, they formed a unit of white prisoners to protect themselves against the black prisoners.
Now, so this is in California.
California. So it started out, the very genesis of gangs and prisons was based upon white people protect themselves against black people, against Hispanic people. So you have Hispanic gangs, black gangs, and white gangs. And that's why it started. Then after they realized how much power they had and kids started getting out, they're members of the Aryan Brotherhood. In fact, the Aryan Brotherhood joined other white groups to protect themselves against the black gangs. And then when they realized they could make money off the prison stuff going on, make money on the outside, they graduated into that. And I know this is not a smart thing to say, but I think that, and we talked about this earlier, I think you could stop a lot of this gang violence if you would segregate units. And I know that's not a
long racial
thing to
lines.
Say. Yeah, long racial lines. Because that was the genesis of gangs to begin with, of ethnic groups protecting themselves against other ethnic groups. And I think Larry Douglas is an African-American. I would love to hear his comment about my idea of having segregated prisons to eliminate the gang activity.
Or at least on that basis.
Yeah, at least eliminate some of it.
Well, I think it would reduce it considerably. You know, on this case, and I'm sort of getting off the point some, Jim, but he's being executed for the murder that he committed. Now, he did have the other offense for which he was in prison for life, but it raises the question of what do you do with him? If he's in prison already for life and he commits a murder inside the prison, and this Taylor was also, when you look at the offense, not only was he a member of the Brotherhood, but he seemed to be acting sort of as the enforcer. He was a young, apparently strong kid, and so he's enforcing the rules. And without getting too philosophical, in some ways, you know, he's doing in his society really what we're doing to him right now. You break the rules and you suffer the consequences. And like Susan was saying earlier, that's sort of where we're. He has his own set of rules. We have our own set of rules, and there are parallels. But as to Jim's question about the segregation, absolutely. I mean, with the kind of racial tension there is in the prison system, to allow them to be integrated in the fashion that they are, just causes problems.
Not working.
There's just way too much friction between the groups. You can't manage the population when you've got that kind of competition between the two races, between the several races. Makes sense.
I was just curious when we had building tenders, which was that ended when in 80.
About 80.
There was a period when basically the prisoners, there was each what do you call it, dormitory? I don't know what.
Well, cell blocks.
Cell block had what's known as a building tender, who was a prison.
Several, actually.
But they were empowered by the administration to have certain authority.
They had absolute power.
Was it segregated at that time?
At one time it was, yes. The fields were segregated. The cell blocks were segregated, yes. And it was the Lamar case that integrated the prison system. And they began.
Was there less violence at that time?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm just kind of looking at this because it seems to make a lot of sense. And, of course, politically, my friends on the left would probably jump up and down and scream.
The
idea that we would be reintroducing segregation.
I don't think it's just the whites that would want to be. You know, I think the blacks and the Mexicans would prefer it that way as well.
I want to say if we put it to a vote of the prisoners, what do you think the vote would be?
Absolutely. I think they would prefer to be with their own race. I mean, we do it out here, too.
We do it kind of more subtly and secretly, right? Where we live and stuff like that.
There, I'd like to answer your question. You said, what would we do with them? Let me parallel it like this. If I put a child in the hospital and I was a doctor because he had an illness, he was diseased, and in the hospital he got a more serious disease, do I execute him? Because here you got a kid that you put in a prison environment when he's 16 years of age, and then we punish him for acting in according to the environment we put him in. And so I don't think you can separate, and I've argued this for a long time, that you can separate the death penalty from prison reform. Because the truth of the matter, prisons are not built to make people better. People get better in spite of prisons, not because of prisons, in spite of prisons. And we put a 16-year-old kid in prison in an environment where he had to act that way to survive, and then we killed him for it. We're going to kill him for it. And my answer is to reform some prisons to help these kids. Yeah, and one thing to do is segregate prisons, be number one. Having long racial lines would be first thing. And number two, try to work on some sort of program to rehabilitate people and have them connected with their family. There we go.
What do we got? Oh, that's the same thing. That's the issue that you're saying. Oh, the witnesses are coming out. Yeah, let's go to Dennis Longmire. Hi, Dr. Longmire.
Yes.
It's my name's Otis, by the way. We've
Hi, Otis.
Before.
I'm sorry. I didn't know you before.
That's cool. So tell me what's going on.
Well, the family members, Tiny's family members, have just literally crossed the street going back into the administration unit, having watched their loved one, their son, their brother, their friend being killed by the state of Texas. And in the name of justice, I cannot myself imagine the horror that they're feeling in their hearts right now. The vigilers are still around, but people are starting to scatter. It's hot out here, and it's not a pleasant place to be.
Right. Okay, well, I hate to say it, but that kind of sums it up. Is there anything else you would like to add?
Well, I just want all of the guys on the row. I know sometimes this broadcast is actually broadcast there on the row, and I want the guys on the row to know there are people in the free world here who care very deeply about them. And people who don't know them at all but care about their dignity, and we pray for them, and we're constantly working to try to rid this society of this horror that we cast upon them.
Okay. Professor Dennis Longmire, Sam Houston University, thanks.
Okay.
On the ground at Huntsville, in front of the Walls Unit. If you've ever been there, it's just the Walls Unit is there. There's a street. The little street, and then the administration building across from the Walls Unit. And, if you've ever been there. Susan,
I
Ashley.
I have a question for Mr. Mudd.
I think you should ask it.
You know, I'm all for every program that would help people in terms of rehabilitation, education, or even like positive recreation, whatever it is. Do you think if there were more, shall we say, available activities for prisoners, things that people could get genuinely interested in, do you think that that would lessen the tension or the violence or the gang activity?
Well, yeah, I believe it would. I mean, it's been proven that education is probably the one of the, you know, the best things you can do as far as rehabilitating yourself, even though the parole board doesn't accept that theory for some odd reason. But, again, for the, all that to work, for these programs to work, you're going to have to eliminate that in, that violent environment. Mm-hmm. And until you do that, I don't think anything will work. I mean, because, as I said, you know, prison is a violent, and it goes back to the, I hate to keep coming back to the segregation thing. I mean, it's like the war on drugs. I mean, if we really want to get down to the bottom of it, the war on drugs is a failure, and we need to go in a different direction. And the same way with the integration policies in the prison. It's created more problems than it's solved. And
one of the definitions of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting different results.
Right.
Let me make a suggestion and get your people's opinion on this. I think the reason is a general rule that most people obey laws because they don't want to disappoint their peer group. They have a good mother and father and good friends. They think if I break the law, I'll be disappointed. Well, what did we do in prison? We change the peer group from the family to other people who are crooks. And we do everything we can to make it difficult for the prisoner to have connection with his family. I think what we should be able to do is permit a prisoner to make some money while he's in prison to support his family. Number two, I think we should permit and encourage family members to come, and when things are well, let the wife spend the night with the husband and let them build up that unit again with their family. Therefore, they can bond.
You do that in Mexico.
Therefore, I mean, you can bond with the family, and you keep those bonds with the family as opposed to your peer group becoming to another guy who's a crook.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's stupid because what you're doing, you're changing your peer group to a bunch of crooks away from the very building block of society.
Right.
So number one, I'd let the families bring in food to prisoners, have as much home contact as you can to build up that relationship with the family, because that's what's going to keep them breaking the law, is not because they're worried about getting caught.
Right.
They're worried about their mother being mad at them.
Right.
And we destroy those bonds by changing the peer group from the family to change it to another crook.
Right.
And that is stupid.
And
we should let families come in, let the children come in, let the wives spend weekends with their husbands. And that, I think that and segregating the prisons would do a lot to solve the crime violence.
Right.
That was,
right.
I think that would, I'd like somebody's comment on that.
Well, Texas is only one of two states that doesn't pay.
And
Maine is the other. Is
but
the
we
other
did prison. For a while. Remember when we had the underwear factory on
well,
LS1
they have a, they have
back
a program
when
they call the PIE program, but only a very selective few inmates are allowed into this program, and they're paid for their work. And but otherwise,
so those are the favorites, basically.
Yeah, right. It's
I mean, that's the
politics yeah, right.
inside the prison.
Absolutely.
You get along with the guards, as the warden like you, the way you cut your hair,
right.
or whatever.
But
it
as
is.
A general rule, you can go in and you can stay there 10 years and you walk out with $50 in your pocket.
Right.
But I think they should be able to at least make, because, you know, part of the ways you get prestige is taking care of your family.
Right.
You should be able to make enough
but
money to at least take care of your
the
family.
Question, the
Otis is interrupting again. Go ahead, Otis.
No, this is the question. And I mean, I totally agree with what you're saying. You know, I mean, there's that original Quaker idea that it was a penitentiary and you were supposed to be penitent and review your life and maybe you would learn something, come out better. And, of course, it's turned into what we have now, these insane sentences.
Right.
I mean, 2 years is plenty of time.
Right.
You know, in 2 years, you're going to not want to go back unless you've been so institutionalized that you can't, you don't
well,
know any
I
other
told
life.
Them, I went the first time for a stick of weed at
for
17
what?
For one cigarette of marijuana.
Right.
And I got a 5-year sentence, and I did 3 years on it.
Think about that.
And
think about what you're hearing here.
It had a devastating effect on my life.
They can't think if you're interrupting him, Otis. Go ahead and let him finish.
You know, I kind of, you know, the old marijuana laws here in Texas, I compare them to the old Rockefeller drug laws in
right.
New York. I mean, you know, at that time, any amount of marijuana carried 2 to life.
Right.
And I was 17 years old, and I got a 5-year sentence. Never been in any trouble prior to that.
Now, I'm saying to people listening, think about what you're hearing.
Right.
Think about the idea of locking up a kid for having some dope.
And
I mean, that's just
time,
crazy.
There were thousands of kids in prisons for small possession.
And we still have that situation in the prisons. But what I'm, what I was going to raise in what Jim said, which makes all the sense in the world, you know, educate people. You have these people who have been through whatever they've been through. Most of them are probably reclaimable.
Right.
Okay.
I still now, think the most important thing is building up that, keeping that bond with the family.
Well, I understand that.
Absolutely.
That's no, but wait. I'm agreeing with you. What I'm saying is the people who run the show know this too. So the question now becomes, why not?
Right.
And one way of looking at a system, this is, we're talking about a system here, you know, the whole criminal justice system is, oh, it doesn't work. The other way of looking at it is to say, yes, it works, but we just need to find out how it's working. That's working, obviously, for the police departments and the criminal justice industry, huge industry, right? It's working for them. And you have people who I'm convinced are afraid we won't have enough criminals if we don't have these schools for criminals in the prisons. So we want to keep it that way. That's, and so everything you say makes sense if the system is supposed to rehabilitate. But it doesn't make sense if you want to be sure that you have a steady supply of criminals. That's what I'm saying. Does that make sense to anybody, or am
I
just...
Absolutely. I mean, let's face it, crime is the largest employer in this country.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that. But, I mean, you look at it, too. Look at the crimes that have been committed on Wall Street. We know this. Right. Eric Schneiderman in New York, the New York City attorney, district attorney, is now starting to prosecute them. You know, they got rid of Elliot Spitzer for this very reason. Eric Holder, our head of Department of Justice, prosecuting nobody, neither for war crimes nor for the criminal fraud that's been committed during this financial meltdown.
Right.
You know, they don't get... But here we have this kid at 16, and we're going to spend all this money on this kid?
Right.
We're, you know, so obviously, when we're talking about crime, we're really only talking about making sure that there's a steady supply of guys on the street who will, you know, steal your wallet. The system is so insane.
The mission statement of TDC is to reconnect inmates with their family.
Yeah,
but it took Judge Justice to force them to have contact. Texas didn't get contact visits until 1986.
Right, and this is from Ruiz.
Justice had to force them to do that.
Right, and he went through hell because he had to do it constantly.
Right.
We're talking about Ruiz.
Right.
If people don't know, Judge Justice was the judge in charge of that.
Right.
Real quick, we have Elizabeth Calvin on the line talking about kids in prison. Does anyone have anything they want to say about what we've been talking about? I don't mean to shut it down. We were running out of time.
I wanted to add to Mr. Mudd what you were saying, that when you were in prison, you were a writ writer, and that kind of kept you out of, shall we say, the fray. You know, when I was talking about rehabilitation, about education, about having meaningful activities, and I think meaningful activities that people, shall we say, that are meaningful. And when you were a writ writer, you could wake up, hit the library, you felt you had a purpose, even though you weren't, quote, paid for it. It was a meaningful activity.
Yes. There were people who validated him through their need for him to write. I assume you started on your own first.
Yes.
And then had a knack for it.
Right. Yes.
That great criminal attorney mind. I'm sorry, Jim.
But I just want to say one thing about this particular, for those that are revengeful and are, you know, are in favor of the death penalty, killing this guy tonight, really, I mean, it's a relief to him. If you want to punish someone, life without parole is punishment.
That's
the bottom line. For those people that are out for revenge and really want the punishment, you know, life. And of course, we also know that we have executed innocent people, and for that reason alone, we don't need the death penalty. It's not being applied right, and I don't think it'll ever be applied right.
Yeah, I'm wondering if George Ryan is in jail not because of fraud, but because he...
Who's George Ryan?
The ex-governor of Illinois, who isn't it George?
I don't know. You mentioned him. I don't know.
He was the ex-governor of Illinois, and one of the last things he did as governor was
commute
all of the death penalty sentences because of the issue of innocence and guilt, whether he couldn't be sure. Okay. Anything else, real quick? because I want to get Elizabeth Calvin. Hi, Elizabeth Calvin. I should say that she's a senior advocate of the Children's Rights Division of Human Rights Watch and works in the area of kids' rights, particularly in the area of criminal justice. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to Execution Watch.
And thank you. Thanks for having me on.
And we're all going to listen to you. So now, are you familiar with this particular case?
I'm sorry to say I wasn't until very, very recently. But I've read a little about it, the little that I could find, I should say.
Well, what do we know about 16-year-olds who break into a house and beat somebody to death?
Well, I think the first thing we know is that they're 16, and you know what neuroscientists, developmental experts, parents, teachers tell us about 16-year-olds is they're not adults. They're individuals who are still developing. And that means a couple of things that are really very relevant to criminal behavior. And one is they don't think things through in the same way that most adults are capable of doing before acting. And it also tells us that they are individuals who are still maturing, developing, and choosing the path that they're going to be on. And so when you look at a 16-year-old who commits a horrible crime, like that one was, I think the correct response from, say, a science perspective, the good social policy response is to say, here is an individual who's still developing. Let's use the tools that we have to see if we can get them on a different path.
Let me. I want to ask Robert Mudd a second. Here's a 16-year-old kid whom I understand was gay. I'm not sure about that.
But I never heard that.
No.
Where did that come from?
Okay, then let me erase that.
I don't think Aaron Brotherhood would take him. That was gay. Yeah. I don't think that's.
I want to say, what would happen to a 16-year-old kid who gets dumped into prison? What's going to happen to him?
Well,
Robert.
I mean, he's going to be, you know, approached. He's going to face extortion. Could be raped. You know, there's a number of things. Especially that young, he's in for a lot of trouble.
If he became a gang member, would he be safer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Would he have to be somebody's buddy to be safe? I mean, we see all these movies. I'm saying, would he have to have a protector who's basically?
Well, the protector is the gang.
Okay.
That's why I joined the gang.
Okay. So, Elizabeth, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you, I just wanted to bring that up in a sense so that we could find out what the experience of this kid is going to be in prison, and I'm assuming it's relatively similar anywhere.
Right. I mean, I think it's similar inside and out. Somebody who is 16, 17, really into the early 20s, these are individuals who are developmentally looking for guidance and figuring out how to be adults. And if you put them into a prison situation, they're going to look for safety, guidance, you know, how to behave from the adults around them. And let's face it, you know, some of those adults are not the best, guides for that journey.
Yeah, I think that's what Jim Skelton and everybody has been saying here. Well, you know, it's gotten popular in Texas. I don't know how popular it is in California, but in Texas, you know, we're very tough on crime here, and we can prove that because we have the second largest prison population in the country. What about life without parole? What about trying a kid of 16 as an adult, which seems to be real popular now?
Yeah, that is, that happens in most, if not all of the U.S. States. Trying kids really younger than 16 in California. Kids as young as 14 are tried as adults, treated as adults, sent to the adult court system, and ultimately sentenced to adult penalties. And I think it's really, it's a myth that everybody in the courtroom participates in, that this individual has the same level of culpability and the same level of ability to assist his or attorney and understand what's going on that an adult would. But we march forward doing this and really choosing to throw away the lives of many kids.
This is where you work. So what are you finding out that people are giving as reasons to do this?
I think the perspective that you mentioned of, you know, got to be tough on crime, that's been a framework for legislators for a number of years now. And really, when you talk about juveniles, starting in the early 90s, there was kind of a hysteria regarding violent juvenile crime and theories that were projected that really some juveniles are super predators who have no remorse and will kill and maim and then move on to the next violent event. And it was predicted that by the year 2000 there would be hundreds of thousands of these super predators. This turned out to be totally incorrect. In fact, we're at our lowest time in history in terms of violent juvenile crime. But nevertheless, laws across the country became more and more severe, increasing ways that juveniles can be tried as adults, and reducing their opportunities for vocational choices, education, or if you want to call it rehabilitation, rehabilitative opportunities.
Well, in your work there, in your work for Human Rights Watch, I assume you have interactions with, you know, legislators and people like that. What are you finding?
You know, what I find is that many of them are still in that framework of being afraid of looking soft on crime. But I think what's happening outside of the Capitol is that the public is becoming more and more aware that, one, young people are different from adults, and there's more of an understanding that we should be treating them differently from adults. I think there's more of an understanding in the public now that a philosophy of incarceration is the only way to handle juvenile crime or kids who commit crime. People are understanding that that's a failed perspective. It's a failed policy. So I think we're kind of on the cusp of being able to bring legislators up to date and have them realize that research supports a different kind of response to serious crime.
How is this getting out to the public? I mean, is the work you're doing getting out? Is there a way people can participate?
Yes. One of the things that we're focused on right now in California is California sentences teenagers to life in prison without the possibility of parole. It's a sentence that means exactly that. Some people call it the other death penalty, and I heard one of your other guests mention that it's a brutal punishment. Some people feel it's worse than the death penalty because of kind of prolonging the punishment in the way that it does. So kids in California are sentenced to life without parole. We have 293 here that are serving that sentence, and we have a bill that is pending before the California state legislature that would basically provide a mechanism for those cases to be reviewed and potentially sentenced to a parolable sentence, and then they would have to work towards parole. So we have throughout the state and actually nationally, literally thousands of people that are stepping up and saying, you know, this is wrong. It's wrong to sentence someone who, by every other law, is considered a child. It's wrong to sentence them to die in prison. People can help by writing letters. We have a website that gives ideas about things that can be done. And what I'm seeing is those letters and those phone calls are a part of the process of educating legislators, and it's a really important part of the process.
So if I just Googled Human Rights Watch, I could find your website.
Yes. So there's two ways to go about it. One would be go Human Rights Watch, and then the very specific campaign website we have is www.fairsentencingforyouth.org. All one word, all words, fairsentencingforyouth.org. And right there, very easy to follow instructions on, what you can do, basically, as well as more information about the issue.
Okay. Is there anything you want to add that, you know, I forgot to ask you?
Well, you know, I would go back to Mr. Taylor's case. I mean, I am just aware that he was just executed. And again, I think it's important to put in perspective a crime and an individual when they're a teenager. And I think in his case, you know, 5 minutes before the crime, child welfare experts in your state would have looked at him. He was homeless, came from an abusive background, and would have said, we need to intervene. You know, we need to place this young person in foster care. We need to find services, counseling, therapy, who knows what else. They would have seen him as a case that needed immediate action. And then 10 minutes after the crime, Texas decides, no, we're going to throw away his life and put him in prison. And I think, you know, our states have choices, and we're making the wrong choice when we send young people to adult prison.
Okay. Elizabeth Calvin, California, working Human Rights Watch for the Children's Rights Division. You know, concomitant with this is Wisconsin trying to get rid of the child labor laws. I mean, you know, it's like, what's going on? This is insane. Anyway,
yeah.
Elizabeth, thank you very much
for
spending this time with us.
Yeah, okay.
And we're back with Jim Skelton here, Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, and Robert Mudd talking about this execution, which took place about 20 minutes ago in Huntsville, of Lee Taylor, who committed a crime when he was 16 and then killed somebody in prison when he was about 20. And got the death penalty for that. So we got to wrap it up. What do we got? And Larry hasn't said much, and Susan hasn't said much. I want to know if you guys have anything to say. And then
Susan always does. Go ahead, Susan.
Speak.
Sometimes I wish I didn't use Botox.
Larry, your comment.
No, I
can't make a face.
Larry, we've talked about a lot of things, particularly the political aspect that we're probably not going to do a whole lot about.
But that's really at the core of this.
That's really what it is.
No one's going to run on being soft on crime.
And some of the things we've discussed, the racial segregation is so politically incorrect now that it's just not going to even be seriously discussed, let alone happen. I'd like to focus a little bit on how focused the system is, though, because when you're in the courtroom where these sentences are handed down, they do tend to focus on what the accused allegedly did. In this case, Dante Green would be the focus. He was killed in prison by an enforcer who said, you know, this is what you get for stealing. And they focus on that, and also focus.
But
on
in a way, that's accepted in the prison.
That
that's
is
what
there.
You get for stealing.
Exactly.
If you're in prison and you steal.
And so he's sending a message, and in a like manner, we're sending a message back that you just don't do that. And people look more for protection, and particularly in Texas, a lot of our overreactions that we fear what people are gonna do to us, so we put them away in prisons, and we'll pay lots of money for doing that.
I can remember when we had a bond issue, what, about 8 years ago? There was a bond issue for schools, which failed. It was like for $200 million or something. And there was another bond issue that was 10 times that for prisons, and it passed.
People are afraid.
Let's talk about solutions. I want to mention something that this is all political, and one of the things I think that's corrupted our system, we have a professional class of politicians, and their primary goal is to get elected, and they're basically paid whores. They'll do whatever the public wants. One of the things we can do is limit the number of terms that a person can run for office, maybe give them 2 terms. Because if your primary job is to get reelected again, you're going to do what you think the public demands. You're always a step behind the public. So I think, number one, eliminate the class of political politicians is the first thing I would do. And you should have, and you should cut their salaries down. But I mean, it's outrageous the things that we pay them. Like Governor Perry, for example, has been nothing but a politician all of his life, and now he's a multimillionaire. And so if we don't have a political class of politicians who become whores, And that's basically what happened. They used the war on crime to scare the hell out of people to get reelected again. And then because of that, they're going to have the prisons filled up again to keep people fearful. And we had everyday people that weren't professional politicians serving our government and doing things well, they would be more responsive to what the public wanted. And I think that we have a class of political politicians at the very basic of the corruption of our system.
That includes state judges.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. As I've often advocated, I think the fair criminal system is not have a professional class of judges, professional class of prosecutors, but to have a criminal bar. And so in some cases, you're assigned to be a judge. On some cases, you're assigned to be a prosecutor. And on some cases, you're assigned to be a defense lawyer. And eliminate these horrible judges who will do anything to get reelected again. I mean, they're some of the most disreputable, horrible people. He would sell their mother's gold teeth to get an office again because they're too lazy to make a living in the free world. And if you eliminate
that... This is Jim at his best.
Well, I'm just telling you, you eliminate that class of people, you could change our system. But the basic problem is we've got professional judges who will do whatever the whim of society says. It's not that they have morals. Our morals is however the wind blows. That's where they're going to go. The same way with politicians. We should not have a professional class of politicians running this country. I think that's the root of the problem.
Lee? Larry, do you have anything?
Just from a practical standpoint, Jim talked earlier about Walter County not doing any death cases. When the decision maker is closer to the actual the purse strings, it's like it just costs way too much. In Harris County,
we've had that happen here, though.
Well, in Harris County, the thought process is so removed from the economic decisions.
But I'm saying in Harris County, we've backed way off, you know, since Johnny Holmes on death penalty cases here.
For economic reasons.
It wasn't economic? It wasn't economic, like in Walter County.
Is Pat Likos.
not like Walter County.
Okay.
The solution's got to be difficult. I raise the question.
Some states have raised this issue about the death penalty being so expensive.
Exactly.
There are states that have actually looked at this so that they don't have to say they're soft on crime.
Well, Walter County,
to wrap it up.
They were very pragmatic.
658, yes.
They have a maintainer than the death penalty. So simple.
Yeah, anything else? Susan? And I'm going to give
in terms of gang violence in prison and what Mr. Mudd was talking about, I really think that, you know, the more that could be done in terms of education, opportunity, meaningful activity, things people that are useful, people that they enjoy, that they feel are positive. For instance, like colleges or universities.
Or Botoxing them.
Well, I mean, online, you could be, you've got a degree online now. I mean, any number of things are possible, but I think it has to do with politically what we want.
Well, true. I mean, they have colleges or universities now that students by choice can elect to go to a alcohol-free drug dorm so they can study in peace. You could, in prisons, you could elect the same.
I got to wrap it up. You've got 10 seconds, Robert. I want 10 seconds.
I just want to remember the other victims, and that's the family of the person that we murdered tonight.
Yeah, and how many people this business of crime affects. It doesn't just affect the guy. It's the whole family and the friends and a whole structure. My name is Otis McClay. I've been sitting in for Ray Hill on Execution Watch. We do this at 6 p.m. on every day that we have an execution. Hopefully it's not too many. Today we executed a man named Lee Taylor. He's found out whatever the mystery is about, and the rest of us still get to. And I want to thank Jim Skelton, Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, and Robert Mudd for being here. My name is Otis McClay. Ray Hill will be on the next one. Stay tuned for Wally.